3. Zarqawi engineered a successful bombing campaign that killed hundreds and made a mockery of the occupying coalition's attempt to secure Baghdad. A massive truck bomb at the United Nations headquarters in the Canal Hotel killed 22, including Sergio Vieira Gemello, the UN's special representative to Iraq. 2 months later, in a barrage of coordinated suicide bombings that killed 35 and wounded more than 200, an explosives-packed ambulance was used to target the International Red Cross headquarters. Though the sewage plant strike was horrific, it was not out of the ordinary for Iraq in 2004. By December, there had been more major terrorist attacks in Iraq alone than there had been in the entire world in 2003. In 2005, terrorism in Iraq would claim 8,300 lives, the equivalent of almost 3 9/11s, in a country with one-tenth the population of the United States. Iraq, with less than one-half of 1% of the global population, accounted for almost a third of all terrorist attacks worldwide and a majority of terrorism's fatalities in 2005. And it only got worse. The spring of 2006 saw more than 1,000 Iraqis dying on Iraqi streets each month. For families like the one-time homeowners in El Amel, local bombings occurred with the frequency of garbage collection in suburban America. Saddam had been ousted and tried, but where a time lapse of Iraqi streets from 2003 to 2005 should have revealed an increase in order and democracy, it would instead have shown a depressing descent. Shops shuttering, roads deteriorating, fewer and fewer people walking around in public, and the incessant orange flicker of suicide bomb attacks. In 2003, oil-rich Iraq's economy contracted more than 20%, putting the per capita GDP at $449, less than 2% of that of the United States. Television news reported the United Nations Development Program's conclusion that conditions were dismal. Iraqis weren't watching it on TV. For them, the experience was visceral. As the fragile edifice of Saddam's government collapsed, electricity shortfalls crippled Baghdad, eliminating lighting, refrigeration, and air conditioning. In a city where summer days top 125 degrees Fahrenheit, and simply brushing exposed skin against sun-heated metal can produce a painful burn, this is bad news. Water treatment and sewage processing plants sat idle, and human waste backed up into the streets, producing an omnipresent, nauseating stench. A place with a history as great as any on earth, the one-time cradle of civilization, had become a living hell. It is worth mentioning that for most Iraqis, things in 2004 were far worse than during the Saddam years. Although he had been a tyrant, driven his nation's economy into the ground, and killed many of his own citizens, the death toll and economic state were not nearly as bad as under AQI's wrath. A useful point of comparison is that through the 1980s and 1990s, the United Nations Human Development Program ranked Iraq 85th out of 160 countries, solidly in the medium development tier, just ahead of Jordan and alongside China and the Philippines. The brutality and mayhem were strategic. Zarqawi's goal was a sectarian civil war between Iraqi Sunni and Shia populations. In destroying each other, he thought, they would also destroy any remnant of a real state, thereby creating a window of opportunity for the Islamic caliphate of his dreams. By strategically targeting Shia Iraqis, Zarqawi ignited a cultural tinderbox, and a sectarian bloodbath swept through Iraq. He had cleverly engineered leverage. Each carefully chosen strike of AQIs would see its death toll multiplied by the chain of reprisals it would set off. Victims of suicide bombs were joined by those who met dark fates at the hands of the sectarian militias on both sides of Iraq's religious divide. Bodies electrocuted and dismembered in underground torture chambers or discarded in garbage-filled alleys with their heads still covered by suffocating plastic bags. Even Al-Qaeda grew uncomfortable with Zarqawi's extremism. But its leaders could not deny the sheer military power of the organization that the Jordanian had mustered. If they wanted to exert influence in Iraq, they would have to work with him. In October 2004, Zarqawi swore bay'ah, allegiance, to Osama bin Laden. And in return, the world's most famous terrorist formally lent his brand to the man who had once been Ahmad. The good-for-nothing from Zarqa. AQI was born. Whiteboards. As members of an entity traditionally focused on targeting terrorist leaders, we in the task force were tempted to succumb to the great man theory and attribute AQI's success to Zarqawi. He was undeniably bright and able. His strategy of pitting Sunni against Shia had an evil brilliance. But ideas are cheap. Plenty of armchair generals have proposals for winning wars, some of them quite clever. But only those who can actually shape and manage a force capable of doing the job ultimately succeed. Zarqawi's AQI certainly profited from Sunni fears, Iraqi resentment of American occupiers, religious fervor, and the general insanity that accompanies violent chaos. But the speed and breadth of their rise was still astounding. The fact that Zarqawi was able to forge a small group of dedicated individuals into a cohesive terrorist organization was not surprising, but his ability to leverage that relatively minuscule group propagating a distastefully nihilist narrative into a broadly supported and strategically effective insurgency demanded deeper explanation. We examined a litany of possible variables, the history of the region, the virulence of AQI's ideology, and the no-holds-barred tactics they adopted. But none could adequately account for what we were seeing on the ground. When we first established our task force headquarters at Balad, we hung maps on almost every wall. Maps are sacred to a soldier. In military headquarters, maps are mounted and maintained with almost religious reverence. A well-marked map can, at a glance, reveal the current friendly and enemy situations, as well as the plan of future operations. Orders can be conveyed using a marked map and a few terse words. There are stories of Pentagon office renovations removing a wall only to find behind it another wall covered in maps dating from a previous conflict. For most of history, war was about terrain, territory held, and geographic goals, and a map was the quintessential tool for seeing the problem and creating solutions. But the maps in Balad could not depict a battlefield in which the enemy could be uploading video to an audience of millions from any house in any neighborhood, or driving a bomb around in any car on any street. In place of maps, whiteboards began to appear in our headquarters. Soon they were everywhere. Standing around them, markers in hand, we thought out loud, diagramming what we knew, what we suspected, and what we did not know. We covered the bright white surfaces with multicolored words and drawings, erased, and then covered again. We did not draw static geographic features. We drew mutable relationships, the connections between things, rather than the things themselves. Just as my siblings and I had on long car rides, played a game where we searched for familiar objects hidden in a larger picture, In the task force, we tried to locate familiar structures and patterns in the chaotic tapestry that was Iraq. Though we couldn't see them, we felt sure they must be there. As we gathered intelligence, we would diagram the relationships between members of the organization. But in place of the straight lines and right angles of a military command, we found ourselves drawing tangled networks that did not resemble any organizational structure we had ever seen. The unfamiliar patterns that blossomed on our whiteboards seemed chaotic and riddled with contradictions. Taking them in was like reading a technical document in a foreign language. The actions that we saw on the battlefield indexed more accurately to these unstable linkages than they did to the more familiar hierarchical structure we were trained to trace. We began to consider the possibility that those familiar patterns we sought might not be there at all, that AQI and this war were fundamentally different from anything we had seen in the past. AQI's adroit use of information technology had multiplied the effectiveness of tactics employed by guerrilla and terrorist groups for decades. That much was obvious. But there was a bigger change at play. The exponential growth of global interconnectedness meant we weren't just looking at the same roads with faster traffic. We were looking at an entirely different and constantly shifting landscape. In contrast to a standard fighting force structure of subordinate organizations and stubborn personalities, AQI displayed a shape-shifting quality. It wasn't the biggest or the strongest, but, like Proteus, AQI was a daunting foe because it could transform itself at will. In deeply traditional tribal Fallujah, the organization dressed itself in the robes of the sheikh and sponsored traditional Islamic poetry festivals. Operatives exerted influence through local proxies on the Mujahideen Shura Council of Fallujah, respected local religious figures AQI won over or intimidated. But if an AQI operative traveled 45 miles east to Baghdad, he blended in with the urban landscape, wore city clothes, and drove vehicle-borne IEDs through the city traffic. Not only did they have no standard modus operandi, they had no standard hierarchy. Every time we thought we had landed a debilitating blow to the organization as a whole, removing a ranking leader whose loss should have derailed them, they bounced back. As network theorist and military analyst John Aquila put it, "We killed about 20 of Al-Qaeda's number threes over the past decade, but everyone in a network is number three." To our way of thinking, an organization without a predictable methodology or clear chain of command wasn't really an organization at all. From our vantage, AQI should have devolved into internal anarchy. But it didn't. It continued to function as persistently and implacably as ever, demonstrating a coherence of purpose and strategy. We saw no evidence that this inexplicable structure was the product of deliberate design. It seemed instead to have evolved through ongoing adaptation. As we would soon learn, it represented something essential about the new world in which we were operating. Actor and environment. Years later, in 2010, I took a teaching appointment at Yale University, where I had the opportunity to reflect on these experiences amid a community of wickedly intelligent people. One interaction proved particularly fascinating. Dr. Christina Talbert Slagle, a brilliant immunologist who studies AIDS, came to see me, curious about whether the similarities she saw between infections in the human body and insurgencies in a state correlated with my observations. They did. While neither HIV nor AIDS kills anyone outright, The human body is weakened to the point where it is fatally vulnerable to otherwise non-threatening infections. The environmental factors that weaken the host indirectly strengthen and empower attackers. In 2004, I lacked this immunologist vocabulary, but I began to realize that an organization's fitness, like that of an organism, cannot be assessed in a vacuum. It is a product of compatibility with the surrounding environment. Understanding that environment would be the key to understanding why we were failing and AQI was winning. We may have had the best equipment and the best special operations units in the world, but we were not, as an organization, the best suited for that time and place. AQI was successful because the environment allowed it to be. A big piece of this was the failure of the Iraqi state, but an even bigger piece was something that extended beyond national borders, something that was temporal, not geographic. A great deal has been written about how the world has become flatter and faster. People are more connected, more mobile, and move faster than ever before. By lowering what economists call the barriers to entry, prohibitive costs associated with entering a market, these changes have ushered in a universe of new possibilities for players operating outside the conventional systems. Mark Zuckerberg, without family connections, starting capital, or an undergraduate degree, changed the world before hitting his mid-20s. Justin Bieber posted a self-made video online in 2007 and has since sold 15 million albums, accruing close to $200 million in personal wealth. And Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, buoyed by online bomb-making instructions and the power to recruit and disseminate propaganda worldwide, incited a war. Interconnectedness and the ability to transmit information instantly can endow small groups with unprecedented influence. The garage band, the dorm room startup, the viral blogger, and the terrorist cell. The 21st century is a fundamentally different operating environment from the 20th, and Zarqawi had arrived at just the right time. It was more than just chat rooms and YouTube. AQI's very structure, networked and non-hierarchical, embodied this new world. In some ways, we had more in common with the plight of a Fortune 500 company trying to fight off a swarm of startups than we did with the Allied command battling Nazi Germany in World War II. If we couldn't change the environment to suit us better, we would have to change to suit it. The question was, how? We were not a handful of renegade fighters operating outside the law and making it up on the fly. The task force was a large, institutionalized, disciplined military machine. Though more agile than most forces, we were still a veritable leviathan in comparison with AQI. How do you train a leviathan to improvise? Managing chaos. Like many soldiers, I enjoy studying military history. Even the most storied of battles can contain revelations with unexpected applications. In 2004, mired in a fight against the most elusive and intractable of enemies, I was fascinated by Adam Nicholson's Seize the Fire, Heroism, Duty, and the Battle of Trafalgar, which chronicles British Admiral Horatio Nelson's daring face-off with a superior Franco-Spanish fleet. On October 21, 1805, the 5.5-foot-tall 47-year-old Nelson stood on the deck of his consort, the HMS Victory, and stared at his enemy. Nelson, who had lost an eye and an arm in earlier battles, knew that Napoleon's Franco-Spanish fleet hoped to decimate his forces, neutralizing the British Navy and making way for a flotilla that would launch a land invasion of Britain. If Nelson's force fell, England fell. The British had not been so threatened since they squared off against the Spanish Armada in 1588. The odds did not look good. Nelson had 27 ships, while the enemy boasted 33. But he had up his sleeve one of the most thoughtfully unorthodox plans in military history. Traditionally, admirals fought naval battles by arranging their ships in a line parallel to those of the enemy. Both sides would fire volley after volley until one fleet, sufficiently weakened due to loss of life, ships, and ammunition, surrendered. This arrangement maximized use of the cannon arrayed along the length of the warships. It also facilitated centralized control. Admirals, positioned toward the middle of their line, could monitor the entire battle and issue orders with relative clarity by way of flag signaling. The face-off becomes a duel of puppet masters. Nelson, however, planned to approach from the side with two columns at a perpendicular angle and punch through the Franco-Spanish line, breaking it into three parts. He hoped to catch the fleet off guard, scatter both side ships, and create such chaos that the enemy's commanders would be unable to issue coherent orders. Drawn on paper or moved as small models on a tabletop, Nelson's daring move could be executed by even a dilettante. But the difference between the environment of a drawing-room tabletop and the tossing seas off the coast of Spain made managing the maneuver challenging. The 227-foot-long Victory was an enormous heaving machine of wood, iron, canvas, and rope, manned by 850 sailors scurrying constantly from the hold below the waterline to the yardarms on the three huge masts. The sailors used a 26-mile maze of hemp rope rigging to raise and adjust the 6,510 square yards of canvas that made up the 37 sails needed to propel the ship. Managing the sails while loading, aiming, and firing massive guns in careful synchronicity with the ship's roll required the careful orchestration of superbly drilled crews. Micromanaging every sailor's conduct across eight decks during routine sailing would have been difficult, and during battle, impossible. It was no drawing-room exercise. Even getting into position for an attack would be risky. Ships' cannons faced port and starboard, and could not be turned to fire toward the bow or stern. Nelson's ships would be exposed to and defenseless against enemy fire during their approach. Once they pierced the line, however, they could fire point-blank through the row of French and Spanish ships, causing far more damage than in the conventional face-off. In the cabin of the Victory on September 29th, Nelson described the plan to his captains, and on October 9th followed up with a secret memo further describing how the fleet should separate into columns to attack the enemy. Maybe more important than laying out a specific strategy, Nelson took care to emphasize the role of the individual captains. At the very core of his plan was what he later termed the Nelson touch, the idea that individual commanders should act on their own initiative once the melee had developed. Noting that plans could be easily foiled, he gave a final, simple piece of advice. No captain can do very wrong if he places his ship alongside that of the enemy. As historian and archaeologist Roy Adkins wrote, the plan of attack was settled and every commander in the fleet knew what he would be doing as a result of these meetings and memos. Nelson, Adkins explains, had patiently instilled the idea in his own commanders during many tactical discussions in the days before the battle. He allowed and indeed expected his subordinates to use their own initiative, at the same time reducing the fleet's dependence on uncertain methods of communication, such as signaling. In contrast, the Franco-Spanish fleet, a few miles away, was under more authoritarian rule. As Nicholson observes, Napoleon had forbidden Vice Admiral Pierre-Charles Villeneuve to tell his captains at any stage what the grand strategy for defeating England might be. Adkins adds that this reliance on orders from a central command proved a recurring weakness in the French and Spanish navies where, by tradition, commanders of individual ships awaited orders transmitted in flag signals that could be hidden by smoke, cut down by enemy fire, or merely misunderstood. The sun rose, the hulking ships raised their sails, and Nelson, his craft at the vanguard of the battering ram formation, led his fleet into battle. Many things could have gone wrong. A slight shift of wind would have meant that the advantage of their weather gauge or upwind position would have been reversed. But nothing did. They broke through the Franco-Spanish lines and sent ships careening in all directions. Things proceeded largely according to plan. The plan being to disrupt all plans. In the wake of the collision, the French and Spanish command was unable to coordinate an effective response. Despite its technical superiority, Napoleon's side lost. 19 of its ships were captured by the British, while Nelson's forces did not lose a single vessel. It remains one of the most stunning strategic successes in naval history. But its lesson is often misunderstood. Nelson was a brilliant man with an ingenious plan who pulled a marvelous trick and won an uphill battle. So goes the story. But what enabled Nelson's forces to win was more than just surprise. The seeds of that victory were laid long before Nelson hatched his plan or told each of his men to place his ship alongside that of the enemy. In fact, Nelson's maneuver wasn't anything that hadn't been done before. The very same strategy had been used many times to great success, in the British Navy no less. While Nelson's tactics echoed those of great admirals before him, his unique innovation lay in his managerial style and the culture he had cultivated among his forces. At its heart, Nelson crafted an organizational culture that rewarded individual initiative and critical thinking as opposed to simple execution of commands. As Nicholson explains it, Nelson created the market, but once it was created, he would depend on their enterprise. His captains were to see themselves as the entrepreneurs of battle. The development of these entrepreneurs took years of training and experience, but as a result of that investment, Nelson knew his force could emerge victorious from a situation of chaos. Nicholson concludes that the British had a cultural and not a technical advantage, reliant on the notion of the band of brothers. The maneuver Nelson pulled that day was clever, but it was just the tip of the iceberg, and the real magic lay beneath the waterline. At the heart of his success was patient, yet relentless, nurturing of competence and adaptability within his crews. Here, for organizations, lies the critical nexus between theorized strategy and realized victory. The ground where doctrinaire theorists and armchair admirals fall short is the decisive terrain from which true leaders emerge. Nelson's real genius lay not in the clever maneuver for which he is remembered, but in the years of innovative management and leadership that preceded it. Limfac. In 2004, I was reading about Nelson, but I felt more like the hapless French Admiral Villeneuve an hour or so into the battle. AQI had created chaos and caught us off guard. Moreover, it managed to maneuver coherently in the ensuing melee, while we, with all our superior firepower, were unable to bring it to bear effectively enough to win the fight. We had everything in place, men, guns, planes, ammunition, medical supplies. But the system that bound these elements together and channeled them toward our enemy required the equivalent of ships in a row and an admiral who could see everything in order to be effective. In the military, where we love abbreviations, we have a term for the one element in a situation that holds you back. A LIMFAC, limiting factor. As we looked at images of charred remains at the LML sewage plant, at the networks ensnaring our whiteboards, and at the new environment that surrounded us, we came to realize that our firepower and legacy were failing us not because of a lack of effort or a shortage of clever tactics, but because of something in our task force's organizational DNA. We were an outstanding 20th century organization. But that was of little use in the 21st century. We realized that of all the unexpected and blindingly obvious things, our LIMFAC lay in the mundane art of management.
Recap. The Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, that our task force confronted in 2004 looked on the surface like a traditional insurgency. But under the surface, it operated unlike anything we'd seen before. In place of a traditional hierarchy, it took the form of a dispersed network that proved devastatingly effective against our objectively more qualified force. AQI's unorthodox structure allowed it to thrive in an operating environment that diverged radically from those we had traditionally faced. The 21st century is more connected, faster-paced, and less predictable than previous eras. Though we encountered this shift on the battlefield, similar changes are affecting almost every sector of society. To win, we had to change. Surprisingly, that change was less about tactics or new technology than it was about the internal architecture and culture of our force. In other words, our approach to management.
Chapter 2. Clockwork. A combat parachute assault is a difficult, dangerous endeavor. To drop a 600-strong battalion of the 82nd Airborne Division onto a pitch-dark landing zone requires intricate planning and coordination. The men must first assemble on an airfield with 12 C-17 transport aircraft standing by, six for men, six for heavy equipment. The paratroopers, fresh from last-minute refresher training, don parachutes and, weighed down by their heavy equipment, file into the planes in careful sequence. Subordinate companies and platoons are cross-loaded through the aircraft so that when they reach the airspace above the start of the drop zone, they can jump in synchronized stages, hoping to land in the vicinity of their teammates and equipment. Paratroopers, bundles of ammunition, and vehicles to be heavy dropped on pallets under huge parachutes are marked to allow for rapid recognition in the dark. To the soldiers, it is a familiar process. They spend thousands of hours in drills emphasizing precision and uniformity so that in combat they can gather themselves on the ground in the shortest possible time, beat off enemy attacks, and reach their objective. The pursuit of order is relentless. Nonetheless, time and again, paratroopers in combat find themselves scattered across the countryside, minus their vehicles and ammunition, and forced to self-organize into LGOPs, little groups of paratroopers, that accomplish the mission as best they can. Even when they land together, paratrooper battalions are still isolated inside enemy territory, without the luxury of immediate reinforcement, and limited, more or less, to what they can carry for supplies. To stand any chance of succeeding, they must learn to get the most out of the little that they have. They must be ruthlessly efficient. Combat parachuting offers a microcosm of the paradox inherent in military operations. The pursuit of predictability, carefully delineated instructions, easily replicable procedures, fastidious standardization, and a tireless focus on efficiency is foundational to the military's struggle against the chaos always threatening to engulf combat operations. Historically, this quest for order has produced impressive results. However, we were learning in 2004 that efficiency was no longer enough. A look into the origins of this doctrine reveals why it was effective at confronting the threats of the 1900s, but has proved increasingly inadequate at battling the networked mayhem of the 21st century. As long as war has existed, military theorists have strived to reduce its practice to a set of principles. Sun Tzu, Machiavelli, Napoleon, and Clausewitz all contributed to this effort, along with thousands of less familiar names. While there is no single accepted theory of everything, my teachers at West Point constantly reinforced the importance of a set of commonly accepted principles. One of the most compelling of these states that commanders should mass the effects of overwhelming combat power at the decisive place and time. Massing combat power usually meant concentrating forces into tightly packed formations that maintained cohesion while battering their similarly configured enemy with club, spear, sword, rifle, or cannon. Normally, the side whose line held won the day. Ironclad discipline and well-rehearsed drills prepared soldiers to stand or maneuver in the face of arrows, charging cavalry, or withering musket fire. Drill manuals became Bibles, and the drill field holy ground. The Roman army was an early and effective employer of the kind of drilled order that we see in a parachute drop. Discipline and incessant drills were hallmarks of life in the legions. The soldier-turned-historian Josephus was said to have described Roman army drills as bloodless battles, and their successful battles as bloody drills. Strict rules governed everything the Roman soldiers did, even the building of their homes. Whether the project was a temporary camp or a permanent fortification in the distant reaches of the empire, the layouts followed the same plan. Every man had a specific construction task, and every tent had its place. This standardization enabled the Romans to construct camp defenses quickly and efficiently. Soldiers could move between units and still participate in construction without breaking the orderly flow of work. Messengers could arrive at camps and forts and immediately know where to find the commander. Most important, in the chaos and confusion of an enemy attack, defenders could organize themselves speedily and effectively. In the winter of 1778, George Washington's ragged army was reborn through a similar focus on discipline and uniformity. Friedrich Wilhelm August Heinrich Ferdinand von Steuben, often referred to as Baron von Steuben, a profane Prussian-born officer who joined the troops at Valley Forge, introduced a training program for drill that was credited with transforming the efficiency and battlefield effectiveness of the fledgling Continental Army. To achieve efficiency and predictability, armies have long dressed, drilled, and disciplined men into becoming interchangeable parts of a military machine. Beginning at enlistment, conscription, or sometimes impressment, soldiers are groomed and outfitted to look as much alike as possible. Uniforms, besides allowing easy identification on the battlefield, also impact behavior. Frederick the Great affixed otherwise useless buttons to the sleeves of uniform coats to stop his soldiers from wiping their noses with them. Today's uniforms enforce erect posture and bearing. More subtly, they help instill loyalty, pride, and inclusion, all part of soldierization. When I joined the Ranger Regiment as a young captain, the standard operating procedures, SOPs, I followed were almost laughably detailed. My rucksack had to be packed with exactly the same equipment as every other Ranger's, and that equipment had to be in exactly the same pocket of the ruck. A folded entrenching tool, a small shovel, was clipped to the left side and further held with parachute cord tied with prescribed knots. Failure to follow the SOPs brought immediate correction, and sometimes the punishment of a Saturday 12-mile foot march carrying the now correctly configured equipment. Such overweening rigor may seem ridiculous. It has certainly earned the term military discipline a reputation as shorthand for any arbitrary exercise in crushing individuality. But most of these regulations developed for a reason. Under fire, and often in the dark, rangers must be able to locate water, gauze, and ammunition in seconds. A correctly packed bag can mean the difference between life and death. When a special operator leaps out of a C-130 transport aircraft 12,000 feet above the ground, it is very important that his parachute was packed by following the appropriate steps with painstaking attention to detail. Just as the road to mastering calculus begins with learning basic addition, the mechanized fastidiousness that ensures that all chute straps are in the right place starts with obsessive attention to small things, like the knots that secure entrenching tools. Most tasks, how to pack a bag, how to conduct an airdrop, how to clear a room of enemy, have been studied and their solutions tested, then practiced by thousands of men and women. Standardization and uniformity have enabled military leaders and planners to bring a semblance of predictability and order to the otherwise crazy environment that is war. Such standards become all the more important as a force grows in size. At the scale of the U.S. Armed Forces, standardization is a necessity. The stakes for military organizations are particularly visible and dramatic. Wars are won or lost, people live or die, but civilian organizations also wrestle with the basic questions of individuality, standardization, and predictability of outcome. Individual companies and entire economies depend on business leaders knowing how best to manage for success. While fighting forces have been developing such protocols since Sparta, the notion of top-down, rigidly predetermined, scientific management of behavior in the civilian sector is largely the legacy of the 19th-century Quaker Frederick Winslow Taylor. His influence on the way we think about doing things, from running corporations to positioning kitchen appliances, is profound and pervasive. For our task force and for other 21st century organizational endeavors, the legacy of Taylor's ideas is both part of the solution and part of the problem. The perfect step. What the 44-year-old Taylor unveiled at the 1900 Paris Exposition Universelle was so beautiful it inspired people to devote their lives to his vision. In a small tent on the outskirts of that famous world fair, he recreated a fragment of the steel factory he operated 3,600 miles away in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. A handful of lathes and a few workers tirelessly churning out metal chips. To the fin de siècle exposition audience, the rate at which his system did this was nothing short of miraculous. The norm was 9 feet of steel per minute. Taylor's system could cut 50. Industrial manufacturing was the sexy technology of the day, and Taylor's display was akin to Steve Jobs introducing the first iPhone. People traveled across Europe and spent hours winding their way through the line outside Taylor's tent before being granted a few minutes to gaze at his system. The French metallurgist Henri-Louis Le Chatelier wrote, "Nobody quite believed at first in the prodigious result, but we had to accept the evidence of our eyes." A British engineer compared Taylor's breakthrough to the creation of the electric light. A prominent design engineer determined that the demonstration was nothing less than a landmark in the history of mankind. So, what had he created? A new steel-cutting machine? A new way of heating or cooling the metal? The brilliance of Taylor's creation was not technological. His machines were very similar to those used by other companies. His genius lay in the regularity of his procedures, regularity much like the intricate execution of a parachute assault. Through a series of experiments, Taylor had determined the optimal temperature at which to cut steel chips, the optimal distance between the machinist and his tools, the optimal way for water to cool the lathe, and the optimal speed for internal conveyor belts. When it all came together, there was not a second of lost time, not an ounce of misplaced material, not a moment of unproductive human effort. Taylor made more, faster, with less. Though not an engineer by training, he was a habitual optimizer by nature. A childhood friend noted that as a young boy walking around town, Taylor would endeavor to discover the step which would cover the greatest distance with the least expenditure of energy, or the easiest method of vaulting a fence, the right length and proportions of a walking staff. This mindset, applied to questions of human organization, precipitated the most influential doctrine in the history of management. At the age of 17, Taylor turned down Harvard to work in a factory. An intellectually gifted child of privilege, he had attended boarding school at Phillips Exeter Academy, where he devoted himself rigorously to his studies and consistently ranked as the top student in his class. A lucrative career in law, following in the footsteps of his father, seemed all but inevitable, especially after gaining university admission at the start of his senior year. But around that time, a spate of headaches and deteriorating eyesight convinced his doting parents that he suffered from overstudying. He was probably just far-sighted. So in late 1874, he boarded a carriage and returned to his quiet Pennsylvania home. After a few months of dawdling, Taylor yearned for something, anything, to keep him occupied. He signed up for an apprenticeship at Enterprise Hydraulic Works, a small company in downtown Philadelphia that made steam pumps and hydraulic machinery. At Enterprise, Taylor fell in love with the gritty hustle and bustle of industry. For the first time, he got to know people who worked with their hands for a living. He learned how the contraptions that filled his home were made, learned what life on the factory floor was like, and even made attempts at cursing, by all accounts, very awkwardly. This sphere of society was far removed from his upbringing on Cicero and George Fox, but Taylor could tell that industry was reshaping the world. He wrote later that his 6 months on the factory floor represented the most valuable part of my education. Taylor became fascinated by the contrast between the scientific precision of the machines in the shop and the remarkably unscientific processes that connected the humans to these beautiful contraptions. Although the Industrial Revolution had ushered in a new era of technology, the management structures that held everything in place had not changed since the days of artisans, small shops, and guilds. Knowledge was largely rule of thumb, acquired through tips and tricks that would trickle down to aspiring craftsmen over the course of long apprenticeships. A veteran machinist wrote that, "Machinists, as a rule, were not very liberal with information of the right kind. Once in a while, someone would give you some good advice, but that was the exception rather than the rule." On Taylor's first day at work, a foreman thrust an unmarked ruler under his nose, placed his finger randomly along its length, and demanded that Taylor tell him the exact measurement. A useful trick, Taylor thought, but why not just have numbers on the ruler? When fashioning a tool bit, Taylor was taught to heat the metal and beat it into a diamond-shaped point. But why that shape? There was no explanation. It was a tradition, he wrote. It had no scientific basis. Each worker had developed his own system of hammering, melting, and hardening, of work and breaks, etc., which each believed to be superior to that of his colleagues. Because there was no forum for comparing their outputs, everyone could continue to operate under the belief that his own system was best. They could not all be right, Taylor thought. There must be one best way. Fittingly, The One Best Way is the title of Robert Canigal's excellent and very thorough biography of Taylor, from which we draw much of this vignette. Although Taylor claimed that he learned appreciation, respect, and admiration for the everyday working mechanic, he also developed an intellectual disdain for the casual, intuitive nature of common laborers' work. He came to believe that their protectionism over trade knowledge prevented industry from achieving its potential for scaled efficiency. Technology had leapt forward, and now management was the limfac. At his next position with Midvale Steelworks, he was put in charge of the factory floor. Everywhere he looked, he saw slack that could be tightened, fat that could be trimmed, seconds that could be shaved off flawed processes. Confident that the men could do more, he raised minimum output rates. In response, workers, who saw him as an arrogant upstart, sabotaged machines and went on strike. Taylor made them pay for repairs, cut their pay, and fired them. After 2 years of struggle, which Taylor later recalled as the most miserable of his life, he had an epiphany. He would not make them work harder. He would show them that it could be done. He would rigorously study practices that had for centuries been left to rules of thumb. He would find the one best way to cut steel, prove that method's supremacy, and then have everyone do exactly that. Thus began a set of experiments that would change the working world for generations. Clockwork. Armed with a pen, a ledger, and a stopwatch, Taylor hovered over workers on the shop floor, timing every procedure, tweaking their actions, and timing again. He hired an assistant to catalog the duration of every variant of every procedure. Determined to be as scientific as possible in his optimizing, he followed the reductionist impulses of classical mechanics, breaking every job down to its most granular elements, analyzing factory labor with similar intellectual tools to those used by Isaac Newton to deconstruct and make sense of the forces of the physical world. In the case of workers at Midvale, this was a series of discrete motions, which he measured, compared, and then reconstructed, calculating the fastest possible way to execute each step. The small gains made by optimizing each tiny element came together to make a substantial difference in efficiency. Based on his findings, Taylor produced prescriptive instruction cards. Instead of being tasked with the general objective of machining a tire, workers were now told to set tire on machine ready to turn, rough face, front edge, finish face, front edge, rough bore, front, finish bore, front. There was a time expectation for each of these movements. Though the notion of a best practice is now commonplace, at that time a workman's methods were part of his art, variable, personalized, and a matter of pride. For people who perceived themselves as skilled workers, being recast as mindless cogs in a larger machine was degrading. They went on strike and quit. In a petition against Taylor's humiliating system, the workers agreed that any man on whom the stopwatch was pulled should refuse to continue to work. Unfortunately for the striking workers, this lacked the impact it would have had a few years earlier. Taylor's system meant that, once researched, evaluated, and formalized, Their skilled jobs became simple steps, executable by anyone. He could find new cooperative workers, and with the massive increases in production gained by his efficient system, he could pay them more. Taylor wasn't afraid of workers quitting. He fired anyone unable to keep pace with what he had calculated to be a hard day's work. Taylor's methods were cruel, but for business owners, his results were undeniable. The cost of overhauling boilers dropped from $62, around $2,000 today, to $11. Machining a tire could now be done in one-fifth of the previous time. Making a cannon projectile now took just 90 minutes instead of 10 hours. 1,200 could now do work that would have taken 2,000 people at any other company. The data vindicated Taylor's belief in the mismatch between the capabilities of technology and the way organizations were run, and confirmed the tremendous potential for improved performance through rigorous, reductionist optimization and standardization. He measured more and more, revealing bottlenecks in the flow of materials and inefficiencies within machines. The physical layout of the room, the nuances of sweeping the floor, the methods of issuing orders, and the protocols for returning materials all fell under the authoritarian choreography of his instruction cards, right down to screwing the spindle of a popper head. He found an optimal solution to every kink and hiccup of workplace life, shaving off fractions of a second here, cents on the dollar there. In a small shop, such savings might have been insignificant, which is why rule of thumb worked fine and intrusive management would have been counterproductive. But at the scale of industrial production, where these gains were multiplied across hundreds of identical machines and thousands of workers, small savings added up to significant differences in productivity and profits. By 1890, Midvale had become an industry leader, and Taylor departed to pursue the broader potential of a workplace ruled by science. Taylor's efforts dovetailed nicely with contemporary scientific thought, heavily influenced by the elegant simplicity of earlier thinkers such as Newton and the French Newton, Pierre-Simon Laplace. Science at the time was dominated by the notion of determinism, the idea that any initial condition has only one inevitable outcome. A ball thrown at a certain speed will have a predictable trajectory, as will a planet in orbit. Throughout the 19th century, phenomena that had once been written off as the work of God fell under human mastery. The vision was of a clockwork universe in which all laws were coherent and all causes and effects predictable. If you knew the rules and the inputs, you could foresee and sometimes manipulate the outputs. The challenge was taking the clockwork apart to see how it all fit together. Taylor created a clockwork factory, systematically eliminating variation, studying all labor until he understood it inside and out, honing it to peak efficiency, and ensuring that those precise procedures were followed at scale. Because he could study and predict, he could control. He dubbed his doctrine scientific management. Taylor became the world's first management guru. At a paper mill in Wisconsin, he was told that the art of pulping and drying could not be reduced to a science. He instituted his system, and material costs dropped from $75 to $35 per ton, while labor costs dropped from $30 a ton to $8. At a ball bearing factory, he experimented with everything from lighting levels to rest break durations and oversaw an increase in quantity and quality of production while reducing the number of employees from 120 to 35. At a pig iron plant, he raised worker output from 12.5 to 47 tons of steel per day and decreased the number of workers from 600 to 140. By the time Taylor's Parisian tent showed the world how Bethlehem Steel could produce 50 feet of metal a minute, The doctrine he had developed to resolve a factory floor fight at Midvale was the gospel of forward-looking industrialists. We have other men paid for thinking.